Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
And I remember for that moment, like a couple of seconds, I'd just come to the realisation I've just been shot in the chest.
Last year, I interviewed Peter Lucky Lukaitis. He's a policeman from Castlemaine. He was involved in a siege at Kangaroo Flat here in Victoria, where four police were shot. Thankfully, they all survived. There were many heroic efforts on this day, which have resulted in a number of bravery awards, not only for police, but also members of the public who put their own lives at risk to assist police who had been shot and lay injured, unable to move. After a 19-hour standoff, the SOG, the Special Operations Group, they were deployed and located the gunman, a man named John Wason, and he was deceased in his home after turning the gun on himself. One of the policemen shot, not only once but twice, was Senior Constable Peter Eames, my guest today. Peter was one of the first to arrive at the scene and was attempting to converse with the gunman when he was shot, first in the chest and then in his leg. Miraculously, Peter survived, as did the other four police who were subsequently shot. This siege remains the single largest number of police shot in the one incident in Victoria's history. But on talking to Peter, the siege pales into insignificance, would you believe, compared with the trauma and grief that he endured in Egypt on the 12th of January 2006. Peter was part of a 90-strong contingent of Australians made up of police and emergency workers and their friends and relatives who were on a professional and cultural exchange with Egyptian police, organised through the Egyptian Federation of Victoria and organised twice a year since 1990. Peter was on a bus which overturned on a desert road around 45 k's from Cairo, where six people died, two of those being Peter's brother-in-law, Mark, and his nephew, Drew. Many more were injured. Peter miraculously survived, yes, yet again, and was taken to Cairo Hospital for treatment for broken bones, ribs, and cuts and bruises. Once Peter recuperated, he returned to policing for another couple of years. I'll check that in a minute. And Peter retired in 2015. Peter's commitment to serving the community didn't stop when he retired. It's just in his blood. So today's very different. I'm going to say welcome, Peter, and thanks so much for your time. But Peter is right here next to me. And no, we're not in my car. We're actually in my office at home. So it's lovely to have you here. And thank you, Peter.
Well, thanks very much, Narelle, for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be here and meet you after a few years.
We worked together. You were downstairs in Bendigo and I was upstairs.
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, thank you. It's very different to have somebody here. It's nice, actually. And can we just clarify? So you returned to policing after the Egypt bus crash. You returned to policing for how many years before you retired?
Well, I came back to work probably in, I think it was August, September of 2006, and I continued on modified duties probably for at least 12 to 18 months, and I went back to general duties again. And I lasted in the job until 2015. That's when I actually tried. So, and so far as years go, I think it's about roughly about 9 or 10 years. I think if my maths is pretty good. Mm. But before I retired, I got a position as a youth resource officer, and I was doing that for approximately 2 years. And so that was good. It was a non-operational position, obviously. So I was able to travel around to schools and different communities, and with all those things that I've learnt over the time, and I interacted well with the young people and teachers and so forth. So that was an enjoyable part of it. But eventually, you know, as with all jobs, the time had come for me, and I knew I needed to leave. Mm-hmm. I was still experiencing some issues in relation to those events that you mentioned that I'd been involved in, and I figured that eventually I would have to get out of this job, because I think being in this job is making me sick. Not what actually what I'm doing, mm-hmm. but just actually being in a policing environment. I need to get out of this completely. Mm-hmm. And so, well, something, you know, some incident or two occurred which made that a reality. So I eventually left officially in 2015. And I have to admit, Narelle, that for the first 6 months of leaving the police force, I felt a little bit lost because that had been my life, my career since I was 22 years of age. Mm. So therefore, I knew nothing else. And I was wondering to myself, at the time I was about 55, sure, many people in the old days used to retire at that age after doing 30-odd years. I did 33 years. Mm. I was in that sort of that position at 6 months, where I was a little bit lost, because in those previous 33, I considered myself to be in a protected bubble. Mm. And that's the way it was. And so now I was outside that bubble, and I found that a little bit scary at the time. But, look, after I took stock of everything that had happened, and I did see some professional people to try to get some assistance and just try to just get on with things in life, because I think anyone that's probably been involved in some very bad incidents and has suffered PTSD knows that it's a very difficult condition, and sometimes it can flare up for various reasons, some even fairly innocuous. But to get out of the police force was probably the best thing I ever did. And as a result of after that break of 6 months or so, I actually became a traffic controller, which was completely different to anything I've done before.
It is just a bit.
Well, the personnel or the people I worked with, let me see, they weren't particularly qualified in anything. Some of them had actually been not all that long before released from jail. Mm. And so it was a different type of people altogether. And I remember at the time not too many people wanted to work with me because of my previous occupation. Yeah. I'm not quite sure about that. But anyway, one guy I did work with who for about 18 months straight, and I learned a lot about traffic and also about him, you know, and that was quite one of the reasons why I wanted to do this. It wasn't just the different job. I just wanted to meet different people and work with different people and just understand their attitudes and how they saw life. Mm.
And maybe who weren't going through a trauma, like just I don't mean this, but just normal everyday people that haven't had something happen, like, because when you're a police person, generally people come to you, generally, when things are bad. So it must have been nice to work with people that just, I don't know, just everyday issues, where they're going to park, what they're going to have for dinner, all that sort of stuff.
Well, exactly. And after the novelty of me being a police officer wore off them, which took a little while with some people, they were so fascinated in all of it.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was bored. I just didn't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
So I often used to talk about other things. And, yes, they would tell me about their lives as we got to know each other, because sometimes we had to drive for hours to get to a particular area to work. And so we'd have a lot of downtime and we'd be able to talk about things. And it was very interesting just to see, as you say, normal people and just get their reactions and and just see what their views of life are and of the world. And I have to say I did learn a lot. I thought I knew a lot after that previous 33 years of policing, but certainly working with some of these people, I did learn quite a bit.
But didn't you say, you told me a lovely story about a young man that you were, you spent a lot of time with in the truck, you know, travelling, and you shared quite a lot. And, yes, you say you learnt a lot, but he would have learnt an awful lot too, wouldn't he?
Well, I think he would have too, because we're actually friends to this very day. He's coming around my place about tomorrow, I think, or the next day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, look, we just formed a friendship. Well, he...
He was a lot younger than you too, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's only 50. He's a child.
He's only a child.
But nonetheless, he did have a very harsh upbringing compared to many of us.
Yeah.
And he, as he became comfortable with me, he did open up to me quite a bit, and he also, I remember at one stage, you know, this is, you know, about a couple of months into, you know, the first time we worked together, and he was talking about his daughter, and that she was somewhat estranged from him, and then I asked him a few questions about the relationship and everything like that, and I actually made some suggestions to him about what might be a good idea for him to sort of reignite the relationship, because I told him that I'd been through the same thing with my three daughters after my wife and I separated.
Yeah.
And he took it all on board, and certain things happened along the way, and now he's got this great relationship with his daughter now, and I'm happy for him. And he's doing really well. He's back into the weights, and he's given up smoking and all this stuff. He's made a real change. So,
good on you.
I'm glad for, you know, I'm sort of partly responsible for that. So
maybe you and I should spend some time together then, Peter, because I need to lose some weight, and I also need, what was it, weight? And I've given up. No, well, I don't smoke, but I could probably do with a little less drinking. But anyway, so you know, with what you're talking about, I think it's hard to imagine for many of us how someone can come back from those, let's say, the tragedies that you've experienced, and that's putting aside all the other incidents that you attended and witnessed, let's say, as a policeman. But obviously we're talking about Kangaroo Flat, the siege, and Egypt. I just think it's a great example of resilience, and it just shows that with the right attitude, with the right support and mindset, that, I mean, look at you now. You know, you've been to the gym. You're telling me you've been to the gym this morning. You're fighting fit. You know, your life's, you've met a really nice woman, and things are really good. I bet just after Egypt, you could never have imagined being in this position.
Correct. Yeah, you're quite right with all that, Narelle. It was a really, really difficult time. And I did, yes, as you mentioned earlier in your introduction, I did find the Egypt incident far, far worse than Kangaroo Flat, mainly because...
That is just, for me, that is just unbelievable. Like, being shot twice, I mean, I've never been in that position, obviously, but it's hard to imagine something could be worse than that, isn't it?
It is for most people, but we're a fairly close family. We were, and losing two members of that family, you know, my brother-in-law and my nephew, that were to me, because we were very, very close. We were very, very good friends. In fact, he was best man at my wedding. You know, we did associate. We just got on. We got on really well, and that's ever since he's been in the family.
Yeah.
And so that was it was a very, very difficult to deal with that loss, you know, because it's of a personal
nature. I was just going to say, but it's different, isn't it, because it's personal.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And it involves members of my family, not someone else, and I can which I can remain completely ambivalent, I suppose, about the whole thing. So, but this one is, it really does strike it at the cords of your life, because losing someone under such circumstances, it was incredibly difficult, and particularly in a country which is far, you know, across the ocean, that don't speak English, and many of their conditions are quite different to what we have here. So that was very difficult as well.
Mm. Yeah, and you're right, though, like when it becomes personal, like as a police person, we can help the people that are traumatised and we can walk away, can't we?
Yes.
And, I mean, you do, I'm not saying you forget it, but you can walk away. But when it's a personal thing, you can't.
That's right.
As you say, it just goes to the core of you.
Indeed, yeah. That's very true. And I mean, yes, like yourself, I've been to a lot of incidents involving death and so forth and major trauma. But I can set aside that because that's the job I do, and that's quite easy.
Yes.
But the personal aspect of it with this particular incident in Egypt, that's sort of something that's going to be a lifelong memory and a trauma of mine that I'll probably never get over.
No.
It's just keeping it in check.
Yes.
And that's the main thing. If I need any help or at a certain time, period of my life, again, in the future, well, I'll certainly seek that.
Mm.
But you mentioned earlier about having a positive attitude and resilience. And, well, that is me because I am resilient. I try not to get too emotional about things.
Mm.
I try to look
at
things
very deeply. But it's okay too, though, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
but I guess when you've been brought up being very objective and so forth, and it's all, and I guess it could stem way back to when you're growing up in, you know, and my father was a fairly hard kind of bloke, hard but fair.
Mm.
And, you know, I think I've grown up very similar to him in some ways.
Isn't that a shame that we can't embrace the fact that men, they feel emotional as well? And when we were kids, it was like a young boy didn't cry. Don't cry. Don't be a girl. I mean, how offensive, but that's how we were brought up, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And it is an unfortunate part probably of our culture, Australian culture, that we did that. And, you know, as we look at it now, it's just wrong in so many ways. And, I mean, in other countries around the world, for Italy and so forth, they're quite forthright in showing their emotions.
Mm.
And it's important to show your emotions. There's times when you need to hold them back.
Mm.
But, of course, other times, such as the personal and emotion, must let them go. You cannot bottle things up because it's not good.
No.
Not good for the head, not good for the body, it's not good for anything.
No, it's not good for anything, no. You were saying that you were a youth liaison officer. You were also, I did a little bit of digging, and I also found out that you were a police negotiator. I cannot think of anything more stressful than a police negotiator, because a lot depends on you. what made you do that, and did you enjoy it?
Well, I remember reading in the Gazette one day that they were looking at training regional negotiators, and I thought to myself, well, this is good because we need that. And it'd be an extra skill that I could have to get negotiators up from Melbourne. Good God, it'd only take a couple of hours get things organised.
Forever.
Yeah, absolutely. So it'd be nice to have, you know, to be trained as a negotiator. And I did the course with a couple of other guys from Bendigo and other one-manners around the place. And I just thought it'd be an extra, you know.
A skill set. Absolutely.
I just thought so. I have to admit, though, to you that it was the best course I've ever done.
Really?
The absolutely best course I've ever done in my whole career, because it was a lot of unknowns.
Yeah.
You know, I recall at one stage, you know, the instructors were just tremendous guys. They were really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were all sort of keyed up to do some stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they all just said to us after dinner, right, go to bed and we'll give, you know, we'll knock on your door when it's time to.
Oh, my God.
A scenario.
Just waiting for the
phone. Yeah. I couldn't sleep really.
Of course you couldn't.
And all of a sudden at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a big bang on the door. Get out of bed. Yeah. And I think,
Out.
And then they said, quick. And then the instructors, all of a sudden, there was like four of us there because that's the team, the made up and negotiators.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, we've got a scenario here where there's a foreign dignitary has been taken hostage, and there's a number of people armed with firearms and so forth. It was probably an incident that probably would not normally occur in Bendigo.
No, you never know. Who would have thought they'd ever see you in Bendigo?
Yeah, indeed. It's true. However, so it was a massive kind of incident, critical incident, and they had the negotiator's bus outside, all hooked up and ready to go. And so we all jumped in the bus, and someone takes over as the prime and mm-hmm. then the secondary negotiator, and there's another one on the boards and everything like that. Mm-hmm. Everyone's got a particular role to play.
Yep.
And then we were sort of going through a lot of stuff. And I have to tell you that by the time we finished the scenario, it was daylight, and it was, it was probably about 8 o'clock or something, like 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
And we just walked out of the bus, rubbing my eyes for sunlight.
Wow. Yeah.
But it was so high impact. It was incredible So it was a great course, fantastic. And I really enjoyed that I did the course. I did learn quite a bit. The instructor did say at the beginning of the course, I remember now, these skills you will not be able to use at home with your wife, so forget that right now. So a couple of blokes got up to, they were going to leave the room because that's the main reason they were going to do it. But nonetheless, but it was, like I said, it was a terrific course. And, look, I've had one or two phone calls. I didn't have much work to do. There was a little bit of an issue with being called out, a monetary issue, a budgetary issue. So they normally, it would be very rare to get called out unless it was a significant issue, because otherwise the sub-officer or one of the members would handle it.
Mm.
We were, you know, of course, it needs probably more attention now, and may well have. We need more equipment and so forth to conduct the negotiating skills. But on the onset, I think, you know, to get trained to be able to do that kind of stuff, and then we can speak to the guys in Melbourne and they can tell them what we've done and so forth, then they can come up and probably take over or assist.
Mm.
So I guess that's probably the main crux of, you know, becoming a regional negotiator.
Mm.
So there wasn't anything significantly interesting I can tell you, but it was just the odd couple of phone calls and that was about it.
But, gee, just the fact that that's really interesting, the fact that you're all geared up to do a job, let's say, and that this is at the training, and then you go to bed, but, of course, you couldn't sleep, and so you would be waiting. But I suppose, like, the training to be able to just, when that knock on the door came, to be able to, you're on from the minute you wake up, I suppose that's something you have to learn, you know, that there's no, oh, go and get a cuppa, you know, go and have a shower. No, you are on.
Yeah, that's right. It's straight away. You're into it. And, of course, the main thing is to be briefed properly on what the situation is before you go in.
Yeah.
We don't know. And some people don't like talking to a negotiator. They might have a particular favourite person they want to talk to. There's so many different scenarios. But being equipped with knowledge, knowing what's going on, and then just slowly introducing yourself to the person and just, well, ascertaining what the issue is.
And I suppose listening.
Indeed. That's of course, that is.
Mm.
Now, we're all guilty of this, listening. And, I mean, still, I would have thought I'd be better at this kind of stuff, but listening to what people say, because people like talking.
Yes.
And especially about themselves.
Yes.
I think that's a general habit of humans.
Yep.
We'd like to talk about ourselves. And so, you know, if you give someone an opening, say, well, look, please tell me about that. I want to know.
Yeah.
And, of course, off they go.
Yeah.
And you just you know, you just sort of reel them in a little bit, or you just let them go and just do what they want to say and so forth. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. So just talking, can we go to the siege?
Sure.
And I suppose if you could tell us in as much or little detail as you feel comfortable, could you tell us about that day at Kangaroo Flat?
Yeah, I was working the afternoon shift van with Gary Harrison, and we did hear an earlier job come over that the other van.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Was sent to an address in Kangaroo Flat for some sort of issue involving a male. But at that stage, we didn't have anything to do with it. And then we were requested by the supervisor to attend the Bendigo Hospital. And the reason for that is because an elderly gentleman was in a hospital bed, I would say probably in a fairly traumatic condition, as a result of being assaulted by John Wason, his father. And we needed to go there and ascertain as much information about this guy to find out what issues he has, and including if he had any weapons and so forth, because we assumed that someone who lived in there would know exactly what's going on. But he was not really overly interested in giving us too much information. I got that feeling for whatever reason, I don't know. But when, as we walked out the door, he said, just watch him. Apparently his mental health had been deteriorating over some time. And we learnt, of course, that it was because of his ongoing use of cannabis and so forth. In any case, after we left the hospital, and I might add that gentleman died several days later.
From the injuries received.
Yeah. So we were fortunate to get in there and have a word with him, at least while he was fairly reasonably lucid.
Yeah.
And then we went to the address, or went out nearby the address, and where I spoke to the supervisor at the time and told him what we'd learnt. And then it was then discovered that I had done the negotiator's course in August, I think it was. I think it was August.
And this is January, isn't it, the siege?
The siege is in October 1st.
Oh, October. Yeah, oh, yeah, my so God. That's even closer.
It is. It's fairly, yeah. It was fairly fresh.
Yeah.
And anyway, so they told me what the circumstances were, that this man had beaten his father. He then called an ambulance to have his father removed. And whilst his father was being put in the back of the ambulance, he told the ambulance officers that he wanted the police to arrive to come to the scene, which I guess you could argue is fairly a bit strange.
Oh, yes, yep.
But anyway, that was the request, and the ambulance obviously did that. And as when the police arrived, the first unit, he basically just wouldn't open the door, just told everyone to go away, blah, and all that kind of stuff. He didn't want to do any face-to-face conversations. And so that's why they called me in, and they just were thinking outside the square that perhaps I might be able to add a little bit more information or light to the matter. So, the first thing was obviously I went to the phone. I went next door to a neighbour and tried to call him on the phone, but he must have removed the phone line was dead, so he must have just removed the connection, I guess. So that eliminated an important part of communications. He was inside the house. I don't know. We couldn't see him. He may well have seen us. I don't know. But we were discussing how we were going to deal with it. And after I came back from the next door neighbours, and during that conversation, all of a sudden he emerged from the property, from the front door, and he walked down the walkway within the property. He had a can of beer in his hand. He was just screaming abuse at us. And I moved forward at that stage, and I just said, John, we're here to help you. That's what we're here for. And, of course, we had all the expletives thrown at us, and he turned around and then quickly walked towards the front door. This was at night time, so it was dark and there was a bit of lighting around, but we couldn't really see the front area of the house. And then I went back to talk to Chief Superintendent Mansell and Tony Commodore, the supervisor at the time, about what we should do next. And it was then at that stage I heard the sound of a .22, which I know quite clearly. And then apparently at that stage they shot me in the chest, right about there. And apparently I must have done a 360 spin and fell on my back on the nature strip. And I didn't have a vest on at that stage, an overt vest. And I remember for that moment, like a couple of seconds, I'd just come to the realisation I've just been shot in the chest.
Wow.
And how am I going to survive this? And then I looked down at my chest and I could see some blood forming around the hole area, and I saw some smoke coming out of my chest. And I thought, okay, this isn't good. This doesn't look too good. And my breathing had gone from normal breathing to about 50%. So it went through my lung when it went through my chest. So I had 50% breathing at that stage, and I was lying flat on my back. The only thing that was protecting me was a small brick fence, which was probably about less than 2 feet high at that stage. And the guys after the shot, the guys obviously withdrew a bit, and then I heard someone say, are you with us, still with us? And I said, yes, I am. I'm here. So I started coughing up a bit of blood at that stage. And then I thought, okay, I'm right in direct fire here. I've got to do something to get myself out of here. And I lifted my right leg and I put it flat down on the ground, and I tried to push away. But as I did that, I heard another shot, and he shot me to the right leg, just on the inside of the right leg. And that really obviously hurt. And from that point forward, I was immobile. I just couldn't. I couldn't move. Yeah. All the blood was rushing to my main organs, just trying to keep me going. And I felt completely helpless. And at that stage, then he was, even though it was a single action bolt action rifle, he was still letting off a lot of rounds, and they were landing around. All these sparks were going off around my head, within a couple of feet of my head. And I'm thinking, well, all he has to do now is move forward, and he could actually finish me right off if he wanted to. So I felt fairly helpless, and of course, at that stage. Now, well, after all that shooting had occurred, one after the other, there was a pause, and that's when Superintendent Mansell said, "Let's get him out of here." And so they just grabbed my feet and quickly grabbed me, and they just dragged me around the corner to safety.
Pretty heroic.
Absolutely.
Yes. Indeed. Putting themselves in the line
exactly
of fire.
Right. They had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
So, yes, and they well and truly deserve their bravery medals and then some.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And then they dragged me around the corner and I stayed there for, well, I'm saying an hour. But it was a long time.
That's a long time.
It was a long time because when I was lying there.
When you know you're dying.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So when I was lying there, I heard more shots go off and I heard the painful cry of someone, a male, and it was obviously Craig Miller at that stage and he'd been.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
He was sort of across the other side of the road. Like it was a fair distance of where he got shot.
Mm.
And yeah, I think he rolled into the gutter at that stage, but I couldn't see. All I could hear was what happened to him. And I'm thinking, oh my God.
Mm.
And I sort of was thinking to myself, am I dreaming or is this whole thing actually happening?
Yeah. Sorry, just to interrupt, but I believe that Craig got shot while he was trying to stop the vehicles going along the road. So he was actually, again, being extremely brave.
Oh, yes.
Heroic yet again by stopping other people getting hurt, and he got shot himself.
Mm. Indeed, yeah. Mm. That's right. I mean, there's yet another act of bravery, and there was many acts of bravery on that particular night, but where members had sort of, you know, foregone their own safety for the for the safety of other people. And that was just fantastic.
Yeah.
and you know, look, it's, again, you know, and unfortunately this man had an objective that evening, and that objective was to kill as many policemen as he could. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I laid there for what I think is an hour, but could have been shorter, but I don't know.
Mm.
Now, again, there was a little bit of a lull in shooting, and I remember Dave Mansell said, we've got to get this guy out of here. We've got to get him out.
Mm.
And they must have flagged down a car that was in the area. And there happened to be an off-duty CFA officer. And he was driving an old EK, I think it was, Holden station wagon.
Mm.
This thing was on the way out. And but
you can't be too choosy in this situation.
I was just going to say, I can't be too choosy. So he backed it up to where I was, opened up the tailgate, and then they lifted me up and just put me head first into the back.
Yep.
And I just lied there like this while they closed the gate up and they said, get him to hospital now.
Yep.
And, of course, all I was looking at was this torn ceiling of this EK station wagon.
Yeah.
And and we were driving along.
That could have been the last thing you ever saw, torn ceiling of an EK.
That's right. What a way to go. So we were driving along, and then all of a sudden it must have been along High Street. He must have got out onto High Street again in the safety. And he started to slow down and he said to me, do you mind if I go through the red light?
Oh, God love him.
I know.
Really?
I said, how's that? That's fantastic.
Oh.
Because he had a policeman in the car and he was conscious of getting a ticket for going through a red light.
A shot policeman
who's dying in the back.
Do you mind if I that's fantastic.
And I really couldn't say too much because I was in a world of hurt at the time.
Yeah.
And then I said, yeah, it's okay. I was going to say to him, I'll sign an indemnity. Just keep going, please. And so eventually we got to the hospital. And we must have been parked in the ambulance bay. And then all of a sudden the back of the car opened up and it was surrounded in nurses and everyone else, all these officials.
Mm. And I remember. And you're fully conscious.
Fully conscious at that stage, still fully conscious.
Yeah.
And then I recall looking at the face of a nurse that was looking at me. She's obviously looking at my chest, and that expression told me a lot about the scenario, the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a nurse who's obviously been in the job quite a long time, and she's seen a fully uniformed police officer with a hole in his chest, and thinking, it was one of those things. I don't think this guy's going to make the night.
Mm.
But anyway, they to their great credit, the staff at the hospital, they took me out, and all of a sudden I ended up in one of the cubicles. And in my surgeon, David Barling, another surgeon worked on me that night. But I remember him saying to me, have you been shot anywhere else? And I managed to lift my left arm and say, like that. So he had a look at that. Okay.
I'm so sorry. So you're just pointing up towards your groin. So it was actually in the top of your leg, not down on your foot or anything?
No, it was the top of the inside leg.
So major arteries.
Well, very, very close. Yeah, indeed. then they had to get this pipe or a drain pipe into my chest. So I'm not sure if they gave me an injection or not, but all I remember is this thing being shoved into my chest, and the pain was just so intense. And that was it. I must have given me a needle, because I don't remember anything else until I woke up a day or two later, I think it was.
Yeah.
And when I did wake up in this hospital room, I woke up and I looked down and I saw this little patch over my chest, and I'm thinking, oh, that's not too bad. That's not too bad. And then I tried to sit up, and I couldn't sit up because I had all these things connected to me that went into my chest area from the back. Because I later learned that the way they did the operation was that they cut me from the rear and they broke open the rib cage.
The ribs, yep.
And that's how they got access to my right lung, because they had to drain it and inflate it again. So that was a significant bit of work that they had to do. God.
And what about the one up near your groin? How they obviously fixed everything up, yeah, and so.
Well, that one, all they did was they put a bit of a patch over it. They couldn't do anything else because apparently because the bullet goes in under such intensity and high heat that it basically cauterizes the skin around.
Oh, yeah, yep.
And so you just have to wait till it closes over. And they said, look, it's in too dangerous position because it's amongst arteries and veins and so forth. It'd be too dangerous for it for us to take it out. So they decided to leave it in. And I saw the X-ray of it and all these little tiny little parts. It didn't look like a bullet. It was all a whole heap of little bits of shrapnel.
Okay.
Which was quite strange.
Yes.
That it worked like that.
Yeah.
But that's the way it was, and that's the way it still remains to this very day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's still in there. However, I'll give you a little story about the bullet up top. I think it was probably about 18 months later. I was feeling some discomfort in my right shoulder. So I made an appointment to see my surgeon, and I said, I think that bullet's trying to get out. What do you think? And I started laughing. He said, he looked at me seriously and said, it probably is. And I said, I said to him, really, is that the case? Does that those kind of things happen? And he says, oh, yeah, there's been cases of old vets that have come back and, you know, a bit of shrapnel might have forced its way through the sole of their foot.
Yeah.
You know, the body's just eventually just rejected it, and that's what's happened to me.
Yeah.
So they did an X-ray, and this particular bullet, which was full, was an inch under the surface. So that's where it traveled from the centre of my chest, gone right around through my right lung, and somehow managed to get up where they extracted it around that area there.
Yeah, at the top of your shoulder.
Top of my shoulder.
And so you're saying that the bullet that went into your chest, they managed to fix the injury, but the bullet remained. They couldn't take the bullet out.
No, it was actually an area around here somewhere. It was, again, amongst too many organs and arteries and so forth. So
they left it.
So they left it there, yes. They left it there. And
it made its way to your shoulder.
Incredible. As it is, it's quite incredible.
And is it still there today?
No.
Oh,
because
okay.
I was a day patient at Bendigo Hospital to have the bullet removed. And I have to tell you a quick little story about going in there.
God.
Because on day surgery, you know, there's a whole heap of people. I don't know if you've been there before.
Oh, yes, I have. Course, yeah.
And there's people everywhere just waiting to get their number called and so forth. And that's the way it was on this occasion.
Sore toenails and, you know, an eye or whatever.
Absolutely. So I was sitting there waiting and patiently. I wasn't really in any hurry. I wasn't in pain or anything like that.
Yeah.
It was a day out.
Yeah.
And one after one, the people, you know, were being seen to. And I was the last person.
Yeah.
And this clearly exhausted nurse with a clipboard under her arm come up to me, and she's gone through it. She said, what's your name? And I told her. And she said, what are you in for? Gastrectomy, colonoscopy. And she went through all the oscopies. And I looked at her and I said, no, I'm not here for that. I'm here to have a bullet removed from my shoulder. And the expression she gave me after that, it was just horror, shocking horror.
Yeah, it would be.
So within a minute, she's disappeared through a set of doors, and then out come someone, an orderly, with a wheelchair.
Yes.
So I got wheelchair support. or the Gold Star treatment, and then taken into theatre.
Wow!
And when I woke up, there was a nurse sitting there by me, and I said, "Oh, where's my bullet?" I said, "Where's my bullet?"
Yeah.
And she had a little specimen jar, and there it was. And
really?
I forgot to bring it today, but we'll see each other again, no doubt, and I'll show it to her.
Oh, I don't know if I'd like to see it. I think it'd make me feel a bit sick. Oh, my God.
Well, it's
and you've still got it.
And I've still got it, and I've been for, what, since 2001, I've been thinking, what am I going to do with it?
What are you going to do with it?
Well, I was thinking I could possibly have a pendant made some sort of jewellery.
Now, see, that's actually really interesting because I would think that the sight of the bullet or the thought that you've got it there, it would bring back such horror and pain and everything that you wouldn't actually want to be reminded of it. But you're saying you might. Well, like, is it almost like a what's that word, a boner? It's probably not the right word. But so you're saying that you're that, let's say, good, as in you've been able to deal with it really well, and you could actually have that, I don't know, let's say, hanging around your chest on a chain or something.
It most certainly was a thought of mine at one stage.
Yeah.
I'm not horrified by the whole thought. It might seem a bit strange to the listeners, but there's some sort of a personal attachment because this bullet was meant to kill me.
Yes.
And it almost did because it skimmed a major artery.
Yes.
Just skimmed a major artery. It was, and I think it's because of the angle that I was standing on when he shot me.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, he said to me, my surgeon said to me, had it gone a little bit further, say a millimetre or two, you wouldn't be standing.
Curtains.
You wouldn't be hit. It'd be all over.
Yeah.
And I actually said to him, I remember, you know, that when he came and saw me for the first time, I just said to him, thanks for saving my life. And, you know, I got emotional, of course. And that's probably the once and only time that I got emotional, but because that's the man that saved my life. I mean, you know, and there's nothing one could say to properly congratulate a man who has done such a thing.
No.
So,
in a way, what an honour for a surgeon. Like, they must feel like that a lot, I imagine, the surgeons and nurses, where they do save people's lives, but that's, you know, that's a couple of steps up from,
well,
you know.
It's something you probably wouldn't be used to in being a regional surgeon.
No.
But I remember the anaesthetist that I had on that particular evening. He's a big South African man, a very jovial kind of man, and he said to me, you know, at some stage when I was in hospital, he said, well, they rang me at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night and they told me that 4 police officers had been shot. And he said, I thought I was back in Pretoria. that's the way he described it. And I couldn't help smiling.
Oh, dear. And so emotionally, physically, you're pretty good?
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Absolutely. I've always been one to, if I'm injured, I get better, and then I work on things, get better, and that's the way I've always been. So, I got a membership under WorkCover after the shooting, and I'll go to the Peter Crenn Centre in Eagle Hawk, and so I've been going there for all that time.
What's that? Sorry,
it's a big gymnasium.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. So, did you feel like you'd had a second chance at life? Like, is that how it affected you, or? Are you in awe of this man as I am? There's so much we can learn from Peter and his positive attitude, isn't there? And as if this week wasn't enough trauma for us to absorb, next week Peter takes us through a tragedy which he says was far more difficult to deal with than being shot in the chest and upper leg. But you'll understand why, because it becomes very personal. Peter was on a trip of a lifetime to Egypt in 2006. With his brother-in-law Mark and his nephew Drew, where he survived a horrific bus crash which killed 6 Australians, Mark and Drew being 2 of them. Peter recalls being one of the few on the bus awake after a very long day and seeing the bus driver nodding off to sleep. And to this day, Peter has pangs of guilt, which he's had to try and manage, because if Peter hadn't invited them along, they would more than likely still be with us today. But Peter's realistic enough to understand that nothing could have forewarned them of what would happen on that bus trip. And to those listening who have lost loved ones on that trip, I apologise in a way for bringing up such a painful period in your life, but those who died, they deserve to be remembered fondly and not forgotten. And it's hard to imagine how there could be some lighter moments in Peter's grief, but he has a kind and caring manner, and he's able to find some moments of pure gold that he shares with us, particularly the Egyptian smoking doctor wheeling in a filthy, bloody IV drip to put into Peter's arm, Peter waking up in hospital to a cat licking his face. Yes, and I'm still having nightmares about that, and his first class trip back to Australia. So have a great week, and we'll talk next week. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.